Thank you, Ross, for coming on the podcast today and joining me. I really appreciate the time. You are the co-founder, president, and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management, one of the fastest growing firms of its kind in the country. Well known for your investments in Tesla, Bitcoin, Nvidia, and some others, and basically have become one of the most influential investors on social media and traditional media alike. I think an interesting place to get started would be, I understand 13 years old, I think your birthday, you received some Apple stock and some Disney stock for your birthday. And maybe that played a part in your early inspiration to become an investor. So maybe we could start there and sort of get a bit of your origin story as an investor.
Yeah, that definitely played a part. Was, the concept of work is different for different people. And most people equate work for how much money they make per hour. And so most jobs pay you by the hour or pay you a salary. Most people work, about 2,000 hours a year, 2,100 hours a year. If you add up the 250 work days a year, it's really hard to make a lot of money if you're working by the hour. And so I realized this as a kid because my grandfather was retired. I got this stock as a kid. My grandfather wasn't wealthy, but he was retired. And my dad worked, 6 days a week. So I was like, boy, this seems like a good deal. How come grandpa isn't living on the streets? And it was like because of dividends from his stocks. And so I started learning about how this all worked, because back then they would send you a check in the mail. So you'd get a check from Disney in the mail, and it would be for $37. It was your dividend. So I would see these checks from my grandfather, and it'd have the company's logos on them. And I think a lot of investors today are disconnected that these are actually real companies that distribute profits, because dividends are just in the account and you don't really see them. And a lot of people now just buy and sell stocks, and they don't even realize these are actual companies that grow and hopefully are profitable and pay dividends. But dividends are one of the key ways to make a lot of money over time, is by buying a great stock and owning it. And as its dividend rises over time, as its profits rises over time, that becomes an income flow for you. And that's what I learned from my grandfather. So compared to my dad, to my grandfather, I was much more fascinated in how I could be making checks, in the mail without having to work, So that was investing. And so when I was 16, I got to a point in my life where I wanted to be really independent, so I was like, I'm going to learn more about money. And so I started learning more about money, and I was working my first job, at an Italian restaurant. I was delivering pizzas and I was a waiter, and I started saving some money then, because my mom was like, oh, you're making this money, you should save it. And that's when I also started buying stocks on my own. And that was through my mom's broker, actually, because they didn't even have online accounts back then. And my mom's broker didn't like it because it was five shares, and they brokers didn't like that. So he wasn't a big fan of me, but I would go in there and buy five shares of Disney or this or that. So by the time I was in college, I was fully convinced that this was a much better way than working by the hour.
Yeah, no, it makes a ton of sense. And I think that's something that a lot of people come to the conclusion. You spend enough time working for the man and you realize you sort of need to have a chunk of ownership in something to really make it. When you were beginning to pick up these shares, going through your mom's broker and picking up five shares of Disney, do you remember any of those sort of early stocks that you got excited about, or some sort of theses that you had when you were young and growing up to sort of get your, feet in the water on investing, and maybe some mistakes that you sort of made early on that you realized, later that benefited you?
Well, really the first real experience was I owned Disney in the 80s when Disney was doing really well. It was the Michael Eisner days. And so they had this thing called a stock split. I didn't know what that was. I was a kid. And then Disney split. It was 3-for-1. And my mom explained this to me, that now I was getting more shares. I was getting all these shares. And I was like, wait, so when it goes up another dollar, now I get 3 times the profit that I was getting before because I got more shares. Wow. And I was like, this is amazing. Then Disney split again. And I was like, I'm done. It's so easy to make money in the stock market. Now, granted, this was the roaring 80s, and then when the 87 crash happened, I was 16 and I didn't have a lot of money, but I remember it. And I remember people jumping out of the building and whatever. I didn't care that much because I didn't have that much money. But I remember that. But I that was the only time I remember the markets going down in the 80s, was in 87. but it was really easy to make money. And then in the 90s, when I started in the industry, it was the same thing. It was just like really easy to make money in the stock market. Things were booming in America through the 80s and the 90s were really profitable times to be in America. So other than periods of time like now, where the government and the Fed is hell-bent on hurting businesses in the stock market, most of the time it's pretty easy to make money in the stock market as long as you are a long-term investor and you own great companies. It's really not that hard. I think the challenging part of the stock market is, if you're really trying to do really well, is really finding the most innovative companies. But in general, if you bought Coca-Cola, like Warren Buffett, you know, just bought Coca-Cola and held it for 40 years, it's worked really well, worked well for Warren, you know. And now Warren Buffett's the big, most of Berkshire Hathaway's just Apple, you know, and I've owned Apple my whole life as well. So if you own these core holdings and they're good companies, you know, and then maybe you're working for by the hour, but then you take your money and you invest it into companies that then grow and pay dividends, your income will grow, your assets will grow, even though you're still working by the hour. This is the way you make more and more money over time.
So you mentioned, you know, 87 was a tough time. Obviously, the dot-com crash, 2000, 2001 was a tough time. 2008 was another tough time. 2010, you decided to start Gerber Kawasaki with Danilo Kawasaki, I believe an old friend of yours. What was your guy's history? How'd you decide he was the right guy to go and start this firm with? And, you know, what was your guy's edge coming in? Why did you think you could do this better than anyone else?
Well, he wasn't an old friend. He was working at my other company. So it wasn't random. Yeah. You know, so I worked for a company that was called Sun America, and then it was acquired by AIG. So during that period of time in the 2000s, it was like, we're AAA rated. We're the biggest firm in the country. It was like, we would use these brands to, you know, sell clients that were solid and safe, and which was true. And, you know, we would align ourselves with these big companies because it helped us, you know. And, you know, there was always this sort of assumption like, why would these ever go bankrupt? These are just hugely profitable banking and insurance enterprises. You know, it's really hard to sink these things, you know. But boy, did we underestimate the amount of greed that was possible in the system. So when the financial crisis happened, that was all thrown away. You know, if you're Merrill Lynch or JP Morgan or AIG, that brand in my mind became nothing, you know. And it was sort of like, and then firms were going under, like Lehman and Bear Stearns. So I was like, we need to start our own firm and just not be aligned with these people. And secondly, I never want my future being held in the hands of bankers and these executives where we have none of the upside, but we get all the downside. You know, it was like, forget that. We're just going to start our own brand. And there were several things that I thought about at that time that ended up being, in hindsight, quite innovative. One of which was, we were the only firm on Facebook at the time. And so, you know, we were posting on Facebook when Facebook was new and we were getting fans and we were the only investment firm doing this. And most firms were prevented from doing this or didn't even know how. And we built up a Facebook following really early on. And we were really ahead because there was no compliance department because everybody got fired at AIG after they went bankrupt. So when we first started GK, we were still with the broker dealer, and we had to get out of that broker dealer and we moved to LPL, but it took us 2 years to do that. But we were just posting on Facebook, growing our social following, and there was like no issues because nobody was checking until like 2 years later or something. And that allowed us to really innovate. And then they were like, oh, we want you to be part of FINRA, which is the regulator's pilot program for social media. So we helped create a lot of the rules that, you know, the original regulators were thinking about for social media. And we were doing all kinds of things when other people didn't do anything. This other innovation was, I didn't want to have branch offices. Everything was bricks and mortar. So, you know, now it was 13 years ago. I was like, one branch will be totally mobile and will be totally digital. And this ended up being very foresightful because I would have never bet that cloud computing and, like, you know, mobile technology would be as good as it is today, but it is so good now. You can run your whole firm. I can run my whole firm off my phone anywhere in the world, which is like insanely crazy. If you go back, I was just telling somebody, that when I started the industry in 1994, when I walked into my office that first day, I had a Windows 95 laptop. And I brought it into work and everybody was like, what the hell are you doing with that? You know, like, you don't need that. You need a phone, you know, you make phone calls and you type stuff on the typewriter. That's when I started in this business, you know, like it's fucking crazy.
Yeah, no,
I literally fought with these people. I would have to write out my tickets, like buy 100 shares of Apple, call in the trade, you know, you call it in, confirm, then you bring it out to your branch manager's office. He'd sign the ticket. You put it in a book full of paper tickets. This was the way it was when I started. And now today, you know, billions of dollars can be managed on a phone, you know, with 45 employees and thousands of accounts. Desktop's a little bit better to use than the phone, but in theory, but this is incredible levels of technology. So we had the foresight to build a digital model, a branchless model, when none of the other firms or banks had that, not knowing at the time that things would get as good as they are. So that gave us a huge leg up on margins and growth because we didn't have to support a branch network with all the rents and all the staffing. And as we grew, we became much more profitable this way. And we're still functioning this way. We still have one office. We have 45 employees managing billions now. So of the innovations when we started, you know, being cloud-based, paper at the time, paperless was a big deal. You know, using DocuSign was a big deal. So we were first to go paperless, being on social, online advertising, and that was GK. My partner is really an operations guy. So that was really the beauty of the partnership, is he really runs a lot of the behind the scenes stuff at the company. And some of this is definitely not as glamorous as my job. And so Danilo is a really core player at the company because of his, you know, real very unique set of skills that are complementary to mine. You know, we have different skill sets. So running a big company is impossible by yourself, really, like a financial firm. And so we partnered together. We had worked together. So we were friends because he actually was a part of my management team at my other company. So when I decided to leave, I basically just asked him to be my partner because I thought, and rightfully so at the time, that he would pull his weight and he would be a huge asset to me growing a bigger company versus starting on my own, kind of just doing it on my own. So I'm very happy about that, you know, decision, you know, 13 years later, and we're still extremely close and work very hard, both of us, to try to manage a much bigger business.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely prescient in a number of ways in the way that you guys set up the organization, from the digital first approach to landing, you know, to finding clients, as well as the digital first sort of way of running the business itself and having, you know, not having a bunch of branches, just having one headquarters, operating primarily online, being on Facebook, eventually Twitter, everything like that. Obviously, you guys were very prescient in sort of the investments that you went for as well. We'll get into that with Tesla and everything else. But before we go there, is there anything sort of today, you know, fast forward 12, 13 years later, that you guys are doing today that you now think, like, from an operational perspective or an organizational perspective, that's sort of like ahead of the curve and other peers of yours aren't really there yet, or, you know, keeping an eye for opportunities like that, or nothing really comes to mind?
No, everything we do is well ahead of our competitors and peers. You know, our firm functions 0% like other firms, you know, and some of the people who work at my firm sometimes struggle with this because they look at the way other firms do things and they're like, why don't we do it that way? And I was like, because that's not our goal, to be a big, slow firm that doesn't grow. You know, most people in the investment advisory business are not growing. You know, it's not a growth industry. Many of the advisors are older than I am substantially. And they just don't see new clients. There's only so many rich people, and the amount of rich people is getting less and less. And, you know, it's like wealth inequality continues to grow, you know? So you got 13,000 advisory firms, you know, sort of chasing, you know, a million rich families in America. But it leaves, you know, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 million, what we call mass affluent families, completely open, you know, who want to build financial plans. And so I think we're fundamentally driven to help regular people. That's probably one of the biggest differences between us and every other firm in the industry. Now think about this. I literally have no purpose in life if it's just making the rich richer. Okay. I'm sorry. And I work with some very wealthy people. It's not like we don't work with these people, and I like wealthy people. That's great. But as far as my internal, like, why do I exist on this earth is not just to make the rich richer. It's not a very satisfying life goal, you know? So the reason why GK exists and why we started this was that I realized as a kid, when I started in the business at 23, that the secret to wealth was starting young. And that's the secret to my wealth. In fact, it's the secret to everybody's wealth who has money, is you just save and invest your money well and live to 85 and you'll be a multi-millionaire. It's really simple. It's not that hard. So how am I going to help you? So we kept getting clients that are 45 and 50 that weren't in a good financial situation. And it's like, how do you help people that have 15 or 20 years to retirement and they haven't done anything? Well, it's really hard. But if I can help people who are 25, I can make all of those people millionaires, 100%. Like guaranteed. Now I can't say the word guaranteed because I always say blah, blah, blah. But I'm just saying that if you save and invest in your IRA or your 401k from the time you're 25 to 75, it's really hard not to be wealthy. So why would I have a firm and then not teach people when I could have the most opportunity to help them? So we have a program for young people. We have a program for kids out of college and their first job. It's called Get Invested. We have a program for when you're younger and you save some money, but you don't have a lot of money yet. It's called Wealth Building. Then we have a program for once you have some money, and now you have maybe a decent amount of money, maybe you're Gen X or millennial now, Wealth Management. And then we have high net worth for people who have a lot of money. So we've segmented our client groups into four main clients groups, but our main client group is the mass affluent. We're really trying to help younger people get ahead. So that's one of the main differences between our firm and others. We serve literally 12,000 client families and something like 17,000 accounts. Okay, with 26 advisors. That's unheard of in our industry. We do that through leverage of technology. So that's the second thing that we do differently than everybody else. Every solution that we have is tech focused. How do we scale our advisors' abilities using technology? It wasn't to replace the advisor with technology. It was how do we enhance the advisor through technology? And through doing this and enhanced trading, we are able to manage more clients per advisor than anybody in the industry and maintain quality, which is really challenging when you scale. So, you know, you might be 35 years old with 200 grand, but get the same service as somebody who has $2 or $3 million with us, because we're trying to provide the same level of service no matter what your wealth level is. Okay. And so this is another huge difference from us, is just the constant focus on technology. And then lastly, just to sum it up, because there's many others, is communication, doing your podcast. You know, if you try to do a podcast and you work at Merrill Lynch, good luck. They don't let you do anything. You can't say anything. You know, it's all about the lawyers control the business. You know, there's a big thing in our industry where the lawyers control the businesses and they're all worried about everything. Now, if you do right by your clients, you don't really need to worry as much. But if you're selling your clients a bunch of garbage like they do at a lot of the firms, they don't want the brokers out there talking because it just brings scrutiny upon them, okay? So they're not allowed to say anything. Plus, if you're a broker, you're not allowed to say anything anyways, okay? Because you're a salesperson. See, what the people at Merrill Lynch and UBS and every major firm, that what they don't want to tell you is that they're salespeople. That's what they are. There's no nice way to tell a high net worth broker at Morgan Stanley that he's just a glorified salesperson. Now they dress up in their suits and say they're the best financial advisors. And oh, we manage billions of dollars for the ultra wealthy. But what they are, salespeople to the ultra wealthy. That's what they are. They're not fiduciaries. Okay. And there's a huge difference. There's a huge difference. When you're a fiduciary, a fee-only financial advisor, and you don't make commissions, okay, you have to do what's in your client's best interest, and you manage money for your clients, okay? So that's a big difference between us and actually most of the firms. Now, there are many independent investment advisories, firms that are fiduciaries, but that is a small part of the overall industry, actually, still. So we're very, very different than our competitors and our you know, friends in the industry, and the communication and transparency at our company is unheard of in our industry. I mean, you can see everything we own. We have an ETF, so you can see all the stocks we own every day, you know, the trades we make. We do these shows. I'm on TV all the time. I do a monthly shareholder meeting, which we're doing, you know, later, where every month we review where the company's at. So if a client of the firm and you just want to know what's going on, there's plenty of information that you can look at every day of what we're putting out that benefits our clients.
I feel like you should
some of the things.
I feel like you should just cut that segment out and post it to the website as like an advertisement. It's like a tremendous overview of the differentiation versus all the competition. But I think,
maybe we should.
Yeah. You know, one thing you mentioned was sort of like the secret, you know, it's not that hard to get rich in the stock market. You just have to start young with some money. And like, that's easier said than done, but it's not impossible. It's like within, you know, reach for a lot of people. You work hard, you get a good job, you save money, be frugal, et cetera, and don't get greedy. On the one hand, you know, that's great advice. On the other hand, you guys wouldn't exist if that was like all you were doing was just sort of placing it on an index on behalf of a client. What you guys do is you identify stocks that you have sort of a thesis on, a long-term investing, mindset, and you bring it to bear on these. And that's, you know, the ones we talked about earlier, Tesla, NVIDIA, and we'll dig into each of these individually. But you guys have sort of found that the best way to bring exposure, at least my understanding, is by sort of doing the index type stuff. And, you know, you have your own strategies there as well. It's not just like placing on the S&P, but then separately where you sort of give exposure to the alpha is through these ETFs where, basically, the rationale, as I understand it, is there's like a real estate equivalent mechanism where you can like 1031 a stock where you sell it and you don't have to, you know, incur the cap gains upon the sale of an individual stock, and you can convert that, you know, the proceeds into another stock. So can you talk a little bit about sort of like how you guys came to that organization? Because I don't think it started that way originally, right? And, you know, how you've sort of managed that since the launch of the ETF.
Going backwards to our investment philosophy. So my basic philosophy, our firm's philosophy, is index plus alpha, which is, you know, certainly if you're an index investor, you're going to make 10% a year over the long term. That will serve most people very well. The problem is behavioral finance more than per se. So I can say all you have to do is this and this, but the problem is people sell at the low and they buy at the high. It's behavioral finance. So it's like in 2021, everybody was throwing money in the market. Everybody was buying everything because it was at the high. And now markets are at a low and you're trying to talk people into buying stocks. They're like, get me a bond. You know what I mean? So we tend to do we do what our emotions tell us to do, which actually doesn't work in the stock market. So it's very hard for individual investors to do this. As a professional investor, I do have emotions, but I am so desensitized to money, you know, in the sense of like gains and losses, because it goes both ways, that for me, like, okay, you know, we're down 80 million this month. Okay, we're buyers here. You see what I'm saying? Like, we don't get scared and all this kind of stuff. I'm looking at a bunch of the stocks we own and going, these are way too cheap now. The sell-off's too much. These rates aren't going to last for long. This is a fantasy. The Fed thinks that the economy's that good now. You know, it's like we went from, they don't know what the hell is going to happen. You know, oh, we're going to be in a recession. Oh, no, now it's growth. Now we need higher rates. You know, and guess what's next is, you know, slowdown. That's coming. So the alpha part of the investment is really where the GK fund came from, was that I personally believe that there are companies that are exceptional with exceptional leadership that you just want to own, and you want to be overweight those companies. So part of that is just concentration. So we own about 30 to 35 companies, but really about 30 companies that I love. Really our top 20 is really our true loves. And, you know, the idea is, what companies are really going to do better than 10% a year? Their growth in earnings, their management, their products and services, and maybe you can get them at a reasonable valuation. And over time, a small percentage of companies have driven the majority of the return in the stock market. You know, so when you look at a company like Apple, over time, it's driven so much return in the stock market. You know, I'm glad I was there. Just like NVIDIA or Tesla. So these are the three main investments, along with Netflix, that we made early on, that we've made hundreds, in some cases, over 1,000% on NVIDIA and Tesla for clients. And part of that is being a long-term investor. You know, I'm having this issue with people in my firm right now who only remember 2 years back. Okay. Now, the problem with young people is if you're 27 or 28, 2 years is a lot of your life. When you're 52, it's not, you know? And the last 2 years have been hard for investing, but people forget how good the 10 years were before. And all you have to do is punch up a, you know, we've been around for 13 years, you just punch up a 13-year chart and you go, wow, we've done well. Our equities have done incredibly well over that period of time. But the last 2 years have been tough. I don't think there's any spin on it. That said, we've had this massive recalibration of markets now because of rates. And that creates an opportunity for the next 5 years. Because now that the recalib supposedly is done at some point, and that higher rates hurts our alpha. So we've underperformed over the last 2 years because we have high growth names, and high growth names with 5% higher interest rates get multiple contraction. But just the same, as rates now drift down over the next 5 years, our stocks will perform very, very well. So it's a great time to get involved. Now, the reason we started the ETF, because it was certainly not the greatest timing to start the ETF, was mostly because of these tax advantages. Because after we made our Tesla score, we made hundreds of millions of dollars for clients, and we realized a big chunk of that for clients because of various reasons, you know, for various reasons. Mostly also, you just can't have Tesla be half your portfolio. So we realized these profits, and we paid tens of billions of dollars in taxes to the government. And I was like, there's got to be a better way for next time. You know, it's just got to be a better way. And then it was explained to me how ETFs have this function where you basically can avoid capital gains taxes. And I was like, so why doesn't everybody have an ETF? And they go, well, because, you know, you have to be an RIA, you have to have a, you know, have a certain amount of money in it. You have to go through all the hoops and compliance. So most people don't do this. And I said, well, but if I, just for me, because I'm actually one of the biggest owners of the ETF, it's me and my family, because I'm like, I'm just going to buy this ETF so I don't have to pay taxes again. You know, like once you get to a certain point with wealth, you know, the taxes get to be a real drag. And so I'm like, I'm starting an ETF for tax reasons, you know, and a lot of people still just don't really fully get this, that if you buy my ETF today, now we got hammered the last month here, 16.30 or whatever it is today, you get, it's, we started at 25. So we also, I realized those losses. You know, so like until my fund even gets to 25, there isn't even an issue with taxes. And then after 25, I can do this, you know, these methods to avoid capital gains that are all legal and all part of the ETF industry, thanks to Vanguard and State Street lobbying the US government. So when I realized the tax advantages, I was like, all right, you know, this is too good. I got to do this. Well, now if you buy the ETF, you didn't take the loss from 25, you know, from the top of the market to now, but you get all the losses in the fund. It's like a super win. So I continue to buy my ETF down here, you know, the lower the better, because essentially I'm never going to have to pay capital gains tax on my gains one day when the markets go back up. So, yeah. So that's the premise behind it. It's a huge advantage. And then there's the second thing is for, scale for our clients, you know, so, you know, I personally oversee over 200 million clients accounts, and then the firm's at 2.5 billion. And so it's like having the ETF allows us to manage money and scale. And then it allows individual investors who maybe are on Robinhood or Schwab, they can also buy in and say, hey, I'm going to buy the SPY and I'm going to buy GK. And, you know, this will give me a good strategy for index plus alpha. So I very much am a believer in owning indexes over the long term. It's a great base to your portfolio. And then you sprinkle in, you know, 20, 30, you know, high growth, great names, maybe some names that aren't even in the S&P, you know, like cannabis companies. And that really gives you the opportunity to make a few more percent over time if things go well.
Yeah, no, it makes a ton of sense, especially from a long-term perspective. You can see people with a short-term frame sort of, you know, it's like immediately unclear. It's like, oh, timing's bad, whatever. But over the long run, the strategy seems very sound. So I think people—
Yeah, once again, the short-term has been difficult, and it's been difficult for all investors in, boy, imagine being in commercial real estate, right? So if you want you know, there's a lot of pain being felt by people who have interest rate sensitive investments, which is basically all of them, you know, so it's just, it is what it is. The Fed is in wealth destruction mode. And that I thought we were ending, And then we started really making money. It was like June and July. We made a lot of money. And I was like, boy, the Fed is finally done killing wealth. And then they were like, no, we're not done again. We're still not done. And it's just like, they move the goalposts every 3 months and it's super frustrating. You know, if I could argue with anybody on about something, it would be Powell. I would love to have an hour to debate Powell over his philosophy for the economy.
Yeah, I would love to listen to that debate, but
never happened.
I'll be crossing my fingers.
Yeah, you can only debate with lightweights. They're lightweights, these Fed people.
I hear you. So let's talk about a couple of those investments in the ETF, a couple of your big winners over the long term, starting with Tesla, of course, number one company in your portfolio. And that's after taking some off the board, probably just because the concentration was pretty ridiculous at a certain point when you make that much, you know, upside. I know you've been, you know, obviously super bullish on Tesla for a long time. A little bit mixed, it feels like, in terms of a temperature check on Elon lately, especially with like the
it's negative. It's solidly negative on Elon, that's for sure.
Solidly negative. So how does that change? You know, you have this company number one in your portfolio, your biggest winner of all time, and you're not digging the CEO. How do you sort of reconcile that thesis right now and holding Tesla long term?
I just want to be clear, you know, I'm very grateful for, you know, the innovation at Tesla and pushed by Elon and Elon's vision and certainly his hard work and obsession with work. I'm grateful for all that. So I don't want to sound ungrateful, but his purchase of Twitter has been one of the worst decisions of his life. And it's been hugely costly to him and his reputation. After reading the book, I had pretty clear belief about some of Elon's emotional psychological issues, but in the book, it becomes very, very clear the depth of his unfortunate dysfunction from his childhood, and it just controls his life. And Twitter was the worst thing he could do for dealing with these dysfunctions he has. And he needs help, to be honest. And it's become painfully obvious because he's tweeting every day and he has no emotions. He just basically is emotionless. So like, he just doesn't understand humans, basically. And so a lot of the things he says and does, he has no consciousness to the way it affects people. And nor does he care much because he has no emotion. So he's put Tesla shareholders in a really tough spot. He's cost us a lot of money. You know, Tesla was a $400 stock. So yeah, it hasn't been a positive contributor of performance for 2 years now. And part of that, Tesla was overvalued in 21 when it was at $400. It was 100 times earnings at the time. But earnings have also gone down because we were at $4 in earnings and now we're at $3.50 in earnings, you know, and that was not the plan. Okay. So we were at $4 in earnings. We were supposed to be at $6 in earnings this year. And now I'm looking at $3.50 and the stock's still trading at, you know, a good 60 times earnings or 50 times earnings, which is the highest multiple in the market. It's higher than Nvidia's. You know, and so they've managed to maintain this, you know, because their other businesses have so much potential and Tesla has so much potential. But the company, you know, for good or for bad, has been poorly managed by Elon, especially from their lack of desire to advertise when demand has gone down and supply has gone up and it's forced prices and margins down on Tesla and earnings down. So I love Tesla as a long-term stock, but I think a lot of the gains have been made. And I think for there to be further gains, earnings have to go up. And what would be the catalyst for earnings to go up when they continue to lower prices on cars? So this is the problem with Tesla. So the CEO, who spends most of his time not working at Tesla, you know, needs to be refocused on Tesla. And so that's what I was pushing to happen. Then it kind of happened. And the first thing that happens is Zach Kirkhorn, one of the top guys, leaves, which it was just a disaster. And now we've got a Cybertruck that's supposed to be launched this quarter and looks to be on track. And it looks to be amazing, but it needs to happen. So, you know, they need to increase sales. They need to keep margins, you know, steady and not continually declining. And they've got all these other products and services that they're working on that are wonderful, but need to become profitable and meaningful contributors to the company. And I just feel like Tesla is a little bit off track. Now, it's not far off track. So if they can launch the Cybertruck, get these other things really happening, I think Tesla's fine. But if they have to continue to lower prices on cars to sell cars, it's just devastating for margins, and the stock can't go anywhere. So, you know, I love Tesla and I love the company. And, you know, one of the reasons it's top holding is because it's all gains, you know, not so much in the ETF, but in my client accounts. So if I do sell Tesla, there's a 30% tax hit, you know, that we were just talking about for clients. So we maintain our position. I think it's one of the most innovative companies in the world. And I think what they're doing over the long term will be very beneficial. But I think on the short term, it's hard to see how they're going to grow earnings.
Right. So if we try to sort of separate the man from the product a little bit, I know you love the product. Right. You've been, you know, screaming that they should advertise the product for a long time. How would you go about, you know, right now they're doing nothing on the advertising front. How would you go about that? What do you love about the product so much that people need to hear that people don't know when they're not advertising it?
So I hired this new nanny or whatever you want to call it, kid player, and play with my kids. And my kids are old enough. It's like, you know, the kid player. So she drives up in this beat up car and I go, how much do you spend on repairs? You know, and it's like a lot. And I was like, why don't you buy a Tesla? Like, you know, you get all these discounts. They're cheap right now. You don't have to pay for gas. Gas is $6.60 now in LA because the Saudis have decided they need to pay for golf. And so, you know, she goes, well, aren't the batteries like bad for the environment? I go, where'd you hear that? She's like, isn't there nowhere to charge? I go, where'd you hear that? And she's like, aren't the cars really expensive? I go, where'd you hear that? You know, and it's like people have all these misconceptions about Tesla because the media has spent years lying about Teslas for the competitors. And people actually believe that Teslas are bad for the environment. I literally have to explain to people that batteries are recyclable, and actually all the Teslas that have been made, none of the batteries have gotten bad yet after 12 or 14 years of Model X sales. You know, so an S sales. So, you know, like there's so much misperception and ununderstanding of electric vehicles, charging, batteries, the environment, the range, you know, like how about an ad that just explains all of that, you know, and then you just put it on where the most people can see it. And you know where the most people are watching? College football and pro football, you know. People watch sports. Advertising on sports is the most effective place you can advertise a general brand knowledge, you know? So like why Tesla doesn't have ads on major events right now all over the country, now that Detroit's on strike and it's like, you're not going to be able to get a Ford, and Tesla's like the best value proposition of any vehicle on the road by so much. Yeah, and then I show the girl, because we were driving in my car, and I go, watch, you want to see something cool? The car drives itself. And she's like, watch. And I push the button, and then it's driving down PCH, and she's like in shock, you know? And this is a 25-year-old. You'd think these people would know everything about Tesla, right? They're online. How about, like, making videos with, like, social media influencers to explain the car to young people, you know? How about just a video about how to get in and out of a Tesla? You know how many people just can't get out of my Tesla because the button is in a weird place to like open the door? You know, people can't get out of my car. They don't know that you got to push a button. You can't pull a lever. There's no lever to pull. You know, people have no idea. So Elon's addressed the addressable market of people who want EVs, who know about Tesla and care about technology. But he has not touched the other 99% of people. And boy, it would help Tesla a lot.
Yeah,
I don't care what anybody says. I'm done listening to all the supposed know-it-alls. And Elon, who supposedly knows everything, which he clearly doesn't. And so one thing he doesn't understand is the value of good advertising. Because he thinks advertising is like selling people something they don't want. But that's actually not what advertising is at all. Advertising is actually about teaching the public about your products so that they can want it.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to form a counter argument there. I think I wouldn't know how to do it, certainly. I think
they try. Oh, they've done so well. How do you think they got to where they were? I go, there were zero EV drivers. Now there are millions. I get that. It was easy to fill demand when there were zero drivers. Okay. But now there's 5 million Tesla drivers. Okay. We need more. Where are we getting them from?
Football,
they
got to
come from ice cars. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I know, you know, your time is money. And so you've got a call after this. So we'll wrap it up here. But Bitcoin, you've been invested since 2014, very early, especially for people coming from like an institutional investing background. What did you see back then? Why are you still holding today? And what's your vision for the future of Bitcoin?
I see the same things today as I did before, and the argument continues to get better and better. Our government, the United States government, might shut down this week. Why? The idiots can't just agree to spending way more money than we have, or a little less than way more money than we have, whatever it may be. But this constant idea that all the world has to have sovereignty around our money is, I think, a joke. I don't think any government in the world deserves that power. And gold used to be the money that everybody used up until I was born. And so, but when I was born, the United States got off the gold standard a couple of years after. And the idea that gold was this international money that we all used was fine for literally 5,000 years. More, it was like 5,800 years. It was perfectly fine to use gold, and everybody could use it no matter what country you were in. This was really useful other than carrying it around, okay? And we got off the gold standard so we could print money that we didn't have, okay? I was just having this argument with somebody. It was the Vietnam War, okay? Nixon ran out of money. We were bombing the Vietnamese. We ran out of money, and it was just the only way was to print more money, and he caused all this inflation because he just printed in the 70s, which was why it has nothing to do with today. You know, people want to compare the 70s to today. It's absurdly not relevant. So Bitcoin is digital gold, and it's basically saying to the world, well, we're going to give you a non-inflationary monetary standard that's digital and quite nice and decentralized, but the world doesn't want it because it involves all the governments of the world saying, oh, we're not going to just print money in mass and devalue our currencies over time, which is basically what all countries are doing. And in some countries, it's happening very rapidly, like in Russia or in Turkey. And so, like, if you're a citizen of Russia, how useful is Bitcoin or China or Turkey, you know, like, or Indonesia or Argentina? Like, I can name bad country after bad country that can't manage its central finance. The argument for Bitcoin is as strong as ever. Okay. Now, the fact that SBF was a big fat fraud criminal, and the Bitcoin industry has been constantly plagued by criminals that have constantly set back the development of this software because of criminals, and the criminals have been involved with Bitcoin for a long time. And for the first time, we have real institutions now starting to get into Bitcoin. And that's what's going to happen next year. They're going to be in Bitcoin, Fidelity being the leader. But Citadel and the other market makers are coming. They're not going to let Fidelity corner the market. They're going to have an ETF at some point. There's the halving next year, and everybody hates it. So I don't think there's a better time to be accumulating Bitcoin if you like risk. It is a risk asset. With rates going higher and you can get 5% in a bank, it makes Bitcoin less attractive. But we all know the government can't afford its debts, and it can't afford paying 5% on $33 trillion. It's, that math doesn't work in any simple fourth grade class would tell you. Maybe they should tell Jerome Powell that he's now put on the United States on a path for bankruptcy. So rates have to come down. They have to print money. And with that, Bitcoin will return. And so, you know, they've tried to kill Bitcoin for the last 8 years or 9 years that I've been following it and owned it. And I'm almost positive that's one thing that won't happen, is that they won't kill Bitcoin. And after this SBF disaster and all the negative and the losses, and, you know, if Bitcoin can get through this and then have institutional players move in and really have some legitimacy as an asset, I think we see Bitcoin double, you know, maybe triple from here.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on all that. Well, I'll let you go. I know, you know, I appreciate you taking the time that you have, and it was great talking with you. And yeah, I'll let you go and take care of the rest of your day. But any last words for you, for the audience, feel free. But otherwise, just appreciate the time. And thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, reach out. If you're looking for financial advice, want to build your financial future, we talked about that earlier on the show. That's what we do at my firm. So reach out, GerberKawasaki.com. Feel free to reach out. We have a free initial consultation. We'll see if we can help you. There's no negative, but we can get your house in order and you can build a great future for yourself. I'd rather work with you when you're young and see you have great success. We're certainly happy to work with you when you're older and have money too. But you know, we'd much rather see you on track with your goals than having to do, you know, surgery and make the patient better. But that said, I appreciate your time. I love working with young people also, because I think there's such a great future in front of our nation and the world if we all work together. So, you know, as a young person, I think the future is as good as ever. I think there's amazing innovations and things happening that can make the world great. And just the same, if we sit on our thumbs and we don't do anything about what's going on, there could be a lot of trouble in the future. So, you know, it's very important that we maintain, you know, our power as young people and invest for change, which is what we do at GK. So thanks for your time.